American Association of Law Libraries 80th Annual Meeting. The Law School Computer Lab. What is the library's role?
Welcome to our program on Law School Computer Labs. Now that most of us are using computers in our own work, we're finding that our law students want access to computers also. In many law schools, this responsibility is being given to the library. Our speakers today will be people who have this responsibility in and out of libraries, and we hope at the end to have time for questions. And I'd also like to remind everyone to please fill out the evaluation forms and leave them on the table in the back. Our first speaker is Nick Pope. As of last week, until last week, Nick was the associate director at the Cleveland State University Law Library. He is now the librarian for the law firm of Arter & Haddon in Cleveland. He has an MLS and JD from the University of Kentucky, and he has had lots of experience with developing computer labs. And he has also served as a consultant to Georgetown University in developing a student computer facility.
Good afternoon. A goal statement for a computer laboratory would be to provide student or user with transportable new business skills that would be valuable in research and the legal profession. The law library will provide a learning facility with appropriate computer devices to allow students to prepare CALI, computer-assisted legal assignments, class assignments of other varieties, written materials. These students will learn and use various law and business software and computer tools. As a preface, 2 years ago, I took a sabbatical from Cleveland Marshall College of Law in Cleveland that was sponsored by the Cleveland Marshall Foundation and the College of Law. And I spent the month of October at the Georgetown University Law Center working with the director, the associate director, the assistant director for public services to develop a computer laboratory to use in their law school environment, their law library environment, that would allow the students to do things that they wanted to do under the strictures that could be established by the law librarians to provide for the best needs of the students. You must do what you need to do to establish your end result. Start at the back and come forward. You want to include the goals of all those who would serve, that's us, or would use, that's the patrons, this facility. The personnel, the staff size that you have, and the accountability and technical expertise of this staff must be addressed with goal setting as it affects the service, the support, and the goal functions. The space, you have to address this right away because it tells you just how much you can do. Do you have space? How can you use it? Can you set the space apart? How much will it cost to set the space aside and perhaps make it a controlled environment? Will you have to remodel? Will you need new electrical service? The access by users, supervision of the users, the copyright protections. At the very outset, you as a librarian need to know, and you need to remind others as well, that you do not want to be a party to or acquiesce in unlawful copying of software disks. The assistance by staff that can be offered to the student or other patron users is important to know. You need to work out as part of your goal setting the technical, formal training for all software used and for all the hardware that's used. Someone has to be able to fix this stuff. Someone has to be able to tell people how to use it. You need to decide early on what equipment you want to serve with, the sort of hardware that you want to purchase, the sort of printers that you would like to use. You need to address your budget. You know what your budget is today, but you need to plan ahead for your budget. You need to be able to set aside those budget items that will allow you to provide a continuity in your computer services. You don't want to start this effort and have it be discontinued for lack of funds. You need to be realistic. You need to be plan realistic on the sour side of realistic. Facility development. You have had your goal setting, you've planned what you want to do, and now you're planning the development of your facility. Development of a microcomputer facility for student use should provide for the anticipated needs of the law student and include CALI, the computer-assisted legal instruction, word processing for preparation of briefs, memoranda, letters, papers. It should include a spreadsheet package for tax or accounting functions and a database manager for business research that requires filing, sorting, and collating of entries. You need consideration for the software specifically developed for the legal profession. Many such software items are available, prepared by bar organizations or by practicing attorneys, and by software publishing companies who are targeting specific professional audiences. These materials typically deal with law office management functions, client billing, court calendar management. More professional materials are bar and jurisdiction specific. There are many examples of major software business packages. Each publisher has its following of adherents that ascribe to that package as the only one that will do the job. This is, in fact, a myth. My prejudice is that once a person has learned to use the intricacies of a specific software, that user will view other packages of like function with a jaundiced eye. Very few people have the time or the inclination to learn more than one program for a given function. There are two important considerations in the selection of a software package for this sort of environment: the ease of use to accomplish the needed activity, and transportability of experience using this package so that you can take that experience to another computer environment, a workplace, or another computer system. Within these two strictures, it is important to note that the varieties of materials available and the important differences between the initial first-generation software and the newer second-generation software. The former products were designed for the user who would or could become completely immersed in the intricacies of the product and who learned to use the system with little regard to the complexity of its operation. The latter products were specifically developed to duplicate the functions of the former, but in response to frequent user complaints of difficulty or arcane operating instructions. The net result is the second generation software tools are both easier to learn and use and often able to perform more tasks. Examples of this division are found in the best-selling business packages, WordStar, Lotus 123, Database 2. Each of these packages is the acknowledged industry leader in sales, or has been in its history. Each has a large following and operates to produce quality results. Each has a well-recognized learning curve that can be difficult to master, and the initial manuals were difficult to use. The second generation of these three functions has developed a large following as well in terms of sales and popularity. WordPerfect, Microsoft Word, Microsoft MultiPlan are examples of products which have captured the sales of first-time users who want a full-featured word processing or spreadsheet package. These perform full-featured, perform all the functions of their first-generation predecessors with additional functions added and greater ease of use and a lower learning curve. MicroRIM's RBase 5000 is the same sort of second generation for database management. Each of these three second-generation items mentioned has found a good following in the software aftermarket that develops ancillary add-on software and training books for the uses of the product. It's a good sign if the second generation or any of the software products has a good aftermarket following. It tells you the product is selling well, people are using it, and teaching people to use it in your library is likely to allow that product to become a transportable skill that the student can use where you are and where they go later on. The products that I mentioned are not particularly recommended but I discussed them as a method of demonstrating that several considerations must be dealt with in buying software for the student use. Hardware guidelines in your laboratory are also important. Within the same framework, a guideline for the purchase of computer hardware is equally important but easier to define. Regardless of your personal preference or your corporate choice, IBM is the industry standard for business use of microcomputer products. This is evidenced by the overt manufacture of IBM clones by other large and prestigious companies who could well have designed their own operating system and system configuration. ITT and AT&T are prime examples of corporations that are both larger and wealthier than IBM and still recognized as its standard for microcomputer business use in the operation of their newer computers. As equipment decisions are made, consideration for this operating system standard is important. Although there are several makers of excellent non-IBM compatible equipment that use operating systems performing the same tasks as the Microsoft DOS used by IBM and its clones, these operating systems do not have a significant amount of independently produced software for business purposes. Apple's Macintosh computer, now that it has added additional memory and a second disk drive, is making a strong push into the business marketplace. It also has an IBM compatibility feature that is, they hope, they being Apple, hope to make it more of a force in the marketplace. If a non-IBM standard machine is used in the computer resource facility you establish, this could be the equipment to choose. It has acquired a large aftermarket of business software and peripheral support. It supports good printing equipment and works easily. It is not as expensive as some other computers. Within the body of machines using the IBM DOS standard, there are several excellent choices of microcomputers, hard and floppy disk drives, and mini computers. Unless advised to include other systems, you, the librarian, in your selection should predicate this upon the choice of the IBM compatible system. Workstations. A workstation is where you go when you want to use your computer. The laboratory. The physical environment of the laboratory. The computer workstation is the individual place where the microcomputer or terminals are kept for patron use. Equipment traditionally placed in the workstation configuration includes the computer device, a monitor, a printer, a desk, or a specially designed table arrangements for the computer and its peripherals. The final determination of workstation design cannot be made until the choice of computer is made. The size and configuration of the computer dictates the choice and placement of all of its peripheral devices. The final choice of the brand of the computer should be made based upon several considerations: the ability of the computer to do the desired work, the support to the law library from the computer manufacturer for operations and maintenance, the acceptance of the IBM standard. Cost generally should be the same for all of the devices that you would want to buy when you compare devices equally micro to micro, mini to mini. There are several configurations of computer from which to choose. There are plus and minus marks for each configuration and its applicability to the library and the student environment. And you need to consider these items carefully when you establish your laboratory. What might work for you in New York might not play in Peoria, as they say. A floppy disk. Most computers have two floppy disk drives, 360K floppies, standard business configuration. A computer generally has 256K internal memory. A hard disk of 10 or 20 megabytes is frequently configured with one floppy drive. That computer generally will have 512 or 640K memory. Mini computers and terminals. A mini computer has more memory and greater flexibility of its microprocessor than it does a microcomputer. It allows for savings in software and micros as it supports a defined number of terminals and uses a single microprocessor for all units. Its memory is such that it carries several software packages which may be chosen by the different terminals as needed. More skill is required in the setup, but less skill is required for the use of terminals. Software savings and no copyright problems are a plus in the selection of a mini computers. Of these possible configurations, I would not choose the hard disk. My prejudice is that this is a volatile system. It needs more attention than the others. It is easy for the inexperienced user to damage a hard disk, and the daily use by many patrons could result in some physical problems. It would not be the most satisfactory system, in my thinking, for the library computer facility. With regard to memory, however, the internal expandable memory of some of the facility computers should be increased to 640K in order to accommodate those users of spreadsheet software who can easily exceed the 256K memory. And this also applies to many of the word processing packages today. Increasing this memory is popularly done by add-on boards. Some have clocks that are valuable for spreadsheet users as well. In preparing the configuration of the computer facility, a cost analysis of the work to be done and the equipment with which it is best done is necessary. This type of facility could be run whether with a small mini computer or an arrangement of terminals or with individual microcomputers. I propose a hypothetical model of 15 end-user workstations, which will include individual keyboards and monitors, and a printer configuration of several printers coupled with a large buffer unit receiving from each user station. Much here is user-specific and will vary greatly from library to library and geographically from area to area in the country. Transportability of these skills the students learn in your library must be regarded in hardware selection as well. The user must be able to move with these skills and recognize familiar soft and hardware. Cost in large urban areas, as well as service and peripherals, will be more advantageous than in smaller communities. Mail order is something to think about. The library will notice as it begins a selection process for software that many software publishers will provide an educational discount. That's not uncommon. You should go for that. Ask for that. Demand every possible consideration for your purchase needs. Remember when you plan for your space that you plan for furniture, for user movement, for noise, for air conditioning. All of these things are important for the user. The library should select software to provide student use. It must select software for which a backup copy can be made in order to protect the library investment. This backup copy should be circulated for use in the computer room. However, many well-known and well-designed software packages are copy-protected. Today, more and more of the most popular software packages are coming without copy protection, which makes it easier for the librarian. But it also makes it easier for the librarian to violate copyright requirements. I would first choose the appropriate software, then take the necessary steps to protect that investment and circulate the materials. The types of software packages in the law college environment should be minimal and predictable. Their classrooms and career choices of the law students should guide them toward traditional business uses in text writing, accounting, and collating of accumulated data. Word processing is something that should be easy to use and require a little mnemonic exercise. You survey your patrons, find out what they want in advance and what they know how to use. The same should be done with spreadsheet choices and database management as well. Students may want to use their own software on the facility. This should be permitted if the software is IBM compatible. However, you should take precautions with protection of their software, have them indemnify you, protection of your hardware, and those people should not expect to be trained. Professional and law office management software is available in several formats. You need to determine if your office practice management component that's taught in your law school would necessitate buying the specialized product. If there is a program such as this in your law school, or if you have an extensive alumni use of your library facilities, or if you have continuing education, then you can consider buying these specialized bar packages that are used in law firms for a variety of purposes. Absent a continuing education tie, a purchase of this software would not be well suited for a student computer resource facility. Cost recovery. You're thinking about cost recovery because this stuff will cost a lot of money. It costs money to buy, it costs money to upkeep, it costs money to use. There are many variables for cost recovery. An easy variable is a user fee that's paid annually either by all the students at the law school or by students that want to use the facility. Or you can have cost recovery by using electric VendiCards. One law school uses a VendiCard device that's attached to the computer and the monitor that operates the same way the VendiCard devices do on photocopy machines. You put your VendiCard in, you purchase 15 minutes. In 15 minutes, when your time is up, the monitor goes blank. It's easy to cheat on this system. The skilled word processing user can go right on ahead and work on their document without looking at the monitor and then turn the monitor back on for more time when it's time to edit and revise. You may want to think about that. Most of the libraries I surveyed did not gather specific statistics about the use of its computer system, but most determined that one-third to one-half of their student body used the computers. Their accounting system typically did not allot a precise amount to computer vendor cards or other cost recovery devices, but they speculated. This survey that I did in 85 and 86 was such that I was trying to determine if people cared about assessing or recapturing costs for use of the computers. At that time, it was not a priority item for most people. The people that paid any attention to it at all and thought that they could recapture were envisioning a recapture that would have been an honest amount. I think each of us can do this in our own fashion, but we have to be straightforward and honest with ourselves about it. You have to actually see the recapture before you can plan for reinvestment and for repair, maintenance, and upkeep. A simple non-VendiCard system would be to sell passes. That's not as likely to generate the income that you would get from the VendiCards. The staffing of a computer facility must be provided from what I would think of as the library's public services department. And they should be primarily responsible for implementation of the procedures to use the facility. They probably will provide the training. They must establish the level of training that would be offered and how the different software would be treated, and understand that training for software is different from training for hardware. Tutorials for the use of the computers and the software can reasonably be expected by the patron. Prior to the purchase of the software for loan, a decision must be made on the level of assistance to be given. There are a variety of training decisions which could be made. It could be reasonable for a library to avoid purchase of circulating software if it were deemed necessary to provide instruction. It would be reasonable for a library to decide to buy the software and loan it to the students with the owner's manual and leave it up to them to do their own tutorials. And the library staff could reasonably expect that patrons would be willing to assume this burden. A tutorial in the use of the microcomputer room is most appropriately given at the beginning of each semester for all interested patrons. Obviously, not all patrons will attend, and follow-up sessions could be planned for designated days of the week at your convenience, not necessarily the individual convenience of patrons one-on-one. I recommend the use of group tutorials for each software package at the beginning of the semester and follow-through instruction as needed. The library should examine independently published teaching aids for the self-trained student assistants. Each of the packages described here has a large body of peripheral training tools, some of which are quite good. Keyboard overlays are very inexpensive, and they're worthwhile mnemonic helping aids. In all cases, containment of staff training for software use would be limited and described to students at the initial contact. When it comes to using disks in the computers, the disk that will store the students' prepared information, I suggest that the library buy good disks that it wants to use, that it require the use of these disks only, and that these should be sold to students at cost or below in order to insist on their use of these particular disks. I have a model for the procedure and the circulation of the system that has pre-registration to sign up to use the computer, times which would be provided for in order to limit sequential using, and you must provide that sort of model for your school as well. Copyright protection and copyright infringement must be subject to discussion within the public services staff. The staff would be remiss in its professional obligations not to presume that some student will attempt to make a personal copy of the library software. Circulation of software for educational purposes is a normal and expected service of a library that provides a microcomputer room for student use. Until the copyrighted provisions are changed to allow for open copying and circulation of these materials, the library is bound to operate within the guidelines of the current provisions. Please note that the copyright provisions which allow library circulation of audio tapes are not analogous to the circulation of computer software. The sound recording provisions are a specific 1984 amendment to the 1976 Copyright Act, and a similar exemption has yet to be passed for software. The circulation procedure must be aware of the differences between these two media. In conclusion, the facility requirements will be developed from the pre-prepared goal statements. These requirements are to provide an environment for the use of computer devices, to further the study of law through research, collection of information, and preparation of written materials based on that research. The transportability of these skills is necessary for students in their later law and business career. Appropriate selection of software and other materials for use in this facility will enable the student who uses the facility regularly to learn modern, new office and business skills that can aid the significant use of the student's time upon entering practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Our next speaker is Pat Harris. Pat is currently the Associate Director at Case Western University Law Library. She's had a variety of positions in several libraries and has an MLS from Oklahoma and a JD from Texas. Pat does have responsibility for a computer lab in her law school, and she'll be telling us a little bit about that and its effect on the reader services staff. Pat?
Slight correction. I used to have responsibility for the computer lab, and now we've hired someone else, and I am his boss. And most of the speech will get around to this. Close to the microphone. I've never spoken before of this kind of a crowd. Is that better? No. Is this better? Okay. First of all, I would like to get a feel for where the audience is at. Can I see a raising of hands of all of you who have already got a lab in the law school? Okay. I thought as much. How many of those of you who have them in the library? Oh, the same number. Very interesting. Almost exactly the same number of hands raised. How many people here are thinking about putting in a lab? Quite a few, but a lesser number than in the raised hands before. Okay, I was curious to see that because that was a very hard kind of thing to figure out several years ago as to who was working on a lab. And at the time when I started getting involved in it, I didn't know who I could talk to. There was no one out there to talk to about it. So I'm very grateful that this presentation is taking place at this conference. First of all, I'd like to tell you that I've divided my speech into two parts. I think that it would probably be helpful for you if I go through a personal rendition of what I did at Case Western, because it's sort of a classic of what not to do. And I think that in the 3 years that I've been talking to people and having people call me and asking, what did I do? Did I do this or did I do that? That it's been very instructive for me to have the experience and say, I did this, but don't do it. You know? And I see this happening. A number of people have called and said, I've got this situation. I have to put in a lab. How should I go about it? So I'm going to just sort of bare my soul and tell you how it happened, first of all. Then the second part of the speech I'd like to get into, raising some philosophical questions that I am really concerned about as to whether or not using reader services staff, and I will probably say public services staff because that's what I'm used to, Reader Services staff for this type of purpose of setting up a lab and troubleshooting and maintaining a computer lab. Okay, so to begin with, how did I get involved in this? To show you how quickly things can happen to you, in March of 1984, I interviewed at Case Western Reserve, and I took the job within a week of interviewing. There was no mention made of a computer lab. I mean, it was not in the works as far as the library was concerned. And I discovered later on, by talking to the faculty members involved, that they had been working on the then Dean Gellhorn for a number of years to try to establish a teaching lab, and that things were sort of coming to fruition. But in March, there was no indication that my position would be involved, nor that the library would be involved in a computer lab. I began work in June 1984 and started to be invited to some discussions that were very nebulous about a computer lab, sort of wondering while I was sitting there, you know, discussing micros and equipment and this kind of stuff, what exactly was going on. By late June and early July, it had been decided, and I've never figured this out as to who decided it and how it had been decided, but it was decided that the lab was going to be located on the third floor of the law library. Okay? I should give you a little kind of detail as to what the third floor of the law library is. It has the bulk of our collection, but it has no staff. The staff are located two flights below, you know, public services and technical services, the entrance to the library, two flights below this area, which was designated for the lab. It was a former typing room area, hence the link, right? In everyone's mind, typing cubicles for typing, we'll just put computers in these cubicles. So, anyway, by July it was decided that that's where the location was going to be. The vice dean of the school started to arrange to cut a deal to purchase the computers. The hardware and software selections had been made by the faculty. All right. So that what has become known at this point is that it's going to be in the library, but the decisions as far as the hardware and software actually were made by the faculty. Okay. Late July, early August, no computers. I'm beginning to get a little worried. Our semester starts the third week of August, and I have not seen an IBM PC, and I haven't actually touched one for 4 or 5 months from the time that I was in my previous job. Okay. Meanwhile, I'm reading madly about microcomputers and trying to get what knowledge I can about the IBM PC. Finally, I got so worried about this that I, in essence, threw a tantrum transfer, and I said, I've got to have a PC. I said, I don't know who you're dealing with. Get me a PC. And so I insisted that they get me a PC and trainers for all of the packages. And in a rather horrendous experience, I consider this kind of like the baptismal fire experience of setting up a computer lab. In the space of 3 or 4 weeks, went from first touching the IBM PC that I had not touched for years to learning about 4 or 5 different packages, turning around, writing those packages up, and trying to get ready for the fall semester. In anticipation, I knew that the computers were going to create a negative impact, possibly a negative impact on the reference services or on the reader services of the school. So in an effort to sort of try to eliminate a lot of mundane fundamental questions about them, Eve Green and I wrote the first edition of the computer lab manual, which I don't know if any of you have got. We've sent about 50 copies of this out over the course of 3 years. The purpose behind writing the manual was just to sort of head off the questions, and it consisted of a brief descriptions of how a computer works designed to be read by the complete idiot. I mean, it was not for anyone who knew anything about computers. It listed the various software packages that are available in the lab, the policies of the lab, who could use the computers, you know, how to go about using, how to register, this kind of thing. It worked fairly effectively when it was finally used. I'm up through August now. I should mention that the dean, who was slow to convince for this, then became a very enthusiastic supporter of it, and as soon as the students arrived in the third week of August, announced that we had a computer lab. The computers, by this time, you have to remember, are not here, right? So of course, the circulation staff, the reference staff, were besieged by these students who are convinced that somehow the success of their law school career, I don't know what he said in this speech to them. I've often wanted to just, you know, to track them down, but somehow the first year is, for sure, got the impression that their success in law school hinged on knowing how to use this lab. So they were just anxious is not the word. They really wanted to know when the lab was going to be in. Okay, meanwhile, we're writing the computer lab manual. We are hiring students. The hardware decision had been to have floppy drives, so we had the circulation of the diskette problem. We have a 3M Tattletape system, and our circulation area is not a large area, and so we have our magnetic desensitizer in the circulation area. So that was out. We couldn't circulate the software from the first floor. But also, you know, physically, we're talking circulating the software. Somebody has to take it up two flights. It's sort of a lack of control over the software. But we decided that we had to hire students to basically act as guard dogs and to circulate the software from the computer lab. So we were in the process of doing that and giving them training them as quickly as we could in the minimal things of just loading the printer and all of that. Okay, the lab, actually I should say that this is another major snafu, I think. On September 12th, the day that I will always remember, the computers arrived at the loading dock, and I trotted off to inform the vice dean, hey, they're here, where's the guy that you arranged to set them up? And he looked at me and said, what are you talking about? And I said, now wait a minute, I understood that you had hired somebody to set these up. You know, you've been making these plans, the law school chose this area, and so forth and so on. It was one of the most interesting conversations of my life. And one of the most depressing, I might add. Turns out that what he had negotiated the contract for the purchase of the software, including some packages for faculty, home use. He'd kind of thrown them all in. And he had negotiated the technical matter of linking the printers. We had four IBM PCs that would share a printer at that time. And he had contracted with somebody who was going to come in at night and cable them. You know, so this was the extent of the support at that time from the law school, much to my surprise. Okay, that had not been obvious before. So we opened. I ended up doing the installation of the software, arranging for the bolting down and all of this kind of stuff. Did it as quickly as I could. We opened October 3rd, 1984. Naturally, because the publicity had preceded the opening of the lab, it was this mass of people. And because we were dealing not, as we are dealing with now, just an incoming class of the first-year students, we had students from all three classes at the door the first day. What followed was 4 weeks of intensive training. It took all of my time, about half the time of another reader services person and half the time of somebody that we took from stack maintenance duties and put on this. It was very obvious to me at the end of the 4 weeks that this could not go on. And by that time, it was also fairly obvious that there are incredible time-consuming troubleshooting and maintenance operations that have to do with computers. And just think about it. If you don't have any, think about the maintenance that is required with photocopy machines, how they break down. You know, you've got to have somebody there as a slave to the computers. So by November, I was in the director's office begging, making my arguments for a staff member. And she passed them on to Dean Gellhorn, who was all behind it and so forth, and thank goodness. And so in January 1985, he established the position of the computer lab supervisor and deliberately hired somebody with a computer bachelor's and who was working on a master's in computer science. From that time on, the situation has been a lot better, as you can well imagine. What have I learned? I mean, I hope that you have seen a number of errors as I've gone on here, you know, from lack of communication between the law school and the library, certainly lack of the goal-oriented planning that Nick Pope was talking about, which is crucial to the whole thing. Everyone totally underestimated the student interest. At that time, people were not aware of a lot of things about micros, which is why all of these mistakes were made. So we were just overwhelmed with the student interest. We also totally underestimated the troubleshooting aspects of the job. But I think in hindsight that the single most important lesson that I learned in this whole thing was to define the goal of why you have the lab in the first place. And that was the big mistake, in my opinion. That was the mistake that was made early on. And it's really been something that we've tried to backtrack and go back on and try to mop up after the fact. The library did, I should add as a final note, that although initially it had this incredible impact and negative impact on reader services, that in the long run, the library, because the dean was willing to provide the support in the position of the computer lab supervisor and has provided monies in subsequent years, the library actually won in the long term. It sort of turned the situation around. This computer lab person that was initially hired to do the troubleshooting and act as the guard dog for the software has made incredible selections, suggestions for hardware and software, which is have freed him up from a lot of those responsibilities, so that, in fact, he is now working on budgeting on RBase, devising and writing programs to help technical services. So that, in essence, we have gained a full-time staff member who is a computer person, who is a programmer, and half of his time is now spent on other things. So it's turned out well, much to my surprise. Okay. I want to raise some issues now that I think you need to think about, because I could not take the time during this evolution to stop and ponder what in the world was I doing and why was I the one that was doing this. This was just, bang, 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 bang. Learn this thing. Learn WordStar. Then learn mail merge. Then go on to the next thing. Now that I have time, I've had a lot of time to think about this, and I've actually seen the lab working for 3 years now, I have some questions that I want to raise, and I think I want to start with what has been traditionally the role of a reader services staff, and that's been to connect the persons who need a resource or information to that information, to act as a link. And then a second thing that is a traditional role of reader services staff is the bibliographic instruction in the use of the library, in the use of the resources that are in the library. I think those are the two primary roles. A third role that is served by us, and this is the one that I think we all sort of hate in some ways, is that we provide the quote-unquote support services to facilitate the legal research, the photocopiers, that kind of thing. For materials that don't circulate outside of the library, we provide these tools that can, these machines that can be used to enhance the research, to make it easier. Okay. I want to look back on the last 10, 15 years a little bit and say, what has been the impact of computers in general on that role, on this traditional role? And I see several things, several types of uses of computers. The first is the advent of Lexis and Westlaw, and first initially shoved away under stairways and kind of ignored. And I think it's probably fair to say that it's now commonplace that both Lexis and Westlaw are routine in law schools, and bibliographic instruction is a normal thing for a reference librarian to do in those two services. I think another use of computers that is growing, I think it happens to be very underutilized, is the use of computers by library staff, technical services, and public services for online database searching in such databases as Nexus.
Please stop your machine at this point and turn this cassette over for side two.
Okay. This is a very high-tech, very popular tool. It is technically a periodical index. The students love it, but everybody sort of gets, into this trend of let's go with the high-tech image. Just want you to think about that for a minute. The fourth and fifth uses that I think I can identify is the use in many schools of a public access OCLC, or I assume Arlen. I've never worked in a school that has Arlen, but I'm assuming that there is such a thing that you can get a contract for a terminal at the reference desk or at the... Anyone use Arlen can verify that? Yes. Is that accurate? Okay. Thank you. And then a further extension of that, of course, providing information as to what the library has, and if you let them search, you can find out who in the region has particular things. And then another use, and I think, of course, the one that people are getting wrapped up in now, is the online or automated catalog. Now, and I'm sure there are others that I've forgotten to identify, but all of those, it seems to me, are uses of computers that are directly related and extensions of the traditional role of a reader services staff. Okay? Now, I would like to spend a minute and say, okay, how then does a computer lab relate to the traditional role? And what impact will it actually have on the lives of the reader services staff? You've heard my personal story of the impact. I think in both cases that the answer to these questions in some ways depends upon the type of lab that a law school envisions. I have, in the conversations that I've had with a number of people who have set up labs, it seems to me the labs sort of fall into two types. The first type is a teaching lab. And I think the ideal teaching lab concept is illustrated by Professor Brill at Chicago Kent. And I will look forward to his comments on it. It's a lab that was set up for students but is totally integrated into the law school curriculum. It has a defined reason for existence that is related to the mission of the school. A second type that is related, and this is one we have used at our school, and is using the lab for a computer and law class so that the class can learn enough about computers to understand the legal questions that are raised by computers. And this past fall, I think it was, one of the professors at our school taught and basically took over our lab for several classrooms and had laboratory exercises. This is another use that's related to the curriculum. I can see a use in practice-related courses, in computerization of law office automation, showing students how this can work, that kind of thing. Certainly can see a use for the legal clinic. You know, to just, you know, they could pretend they're a little small law office and just run everything off of a computer lab. And I can see, and I would love to have, a lab that would have 10 or more terminals that were set up in a teaching kind of mode to teach the computer-assisted legal research, Lexis Westlaw, and I would probably teach dialogue and a number of other things in advanced classes on those same terminals. Many times the lab, and this is sort of quasi-directed, at the curriculum, many times the lab is used for the CALI exercises, the computer-assisted legal instruction exercises. Depending on whether the professor has adopted those in a class, that seems to me to be the success of whether students use those or not. But if they can be done in a self-directed and isolated location, but that is related to the law school curriculum. Those are the kinds of teaching labs I see. My impression is that labs that are teaching labs, the role of the reader services staff, even the role of the library, is going to be completely different, possibly completely different, than in other scenarios. The other type of lab that I see is what I like to call is a glorified word processing lab. Okay, and I fear that that is mostly what we're setting up, that it's the trend and that is what we're setting up. And I didn't realize this until this morning, or this afternoon, differ with Nick Pope on this as to the role that we should have in that. I'd like to question the role. I think that in the teaching kind of lab, the role of the reader services staff ideally would be to teach Lexis Westlaw and the bibliographic instruction on the computers. In either case, in either the teaching lab or the word processing lab, it occurs to me there are a number of reasons that a law school would choose to put the lab in a library. And then the effect on the reader services staff depends to some degree on where it is in the library and what it's used for, whether it's a teaching lab or a processing lab or a shared concept lab. The reasons I think, in retrospect, although he never stated them to me, that the dean wanted the lab at Case Western is that he wanted it to impress the alumni and the local bar, that the school was on the cutting edge of technology, high tech, et cetera, et cetera. I can see in the last 2 years, when the students come in for recruitment, when we hold admissions things and we're trying to recruit, the students seem to be asking, I don't know where they get this from, but the students seem to be asking, how many computers do you have? And they never ask, what do you use them for? You know, that always annoys me. You know, this is sort of like, they want to know how many. They want to know the brand name or the IBMs, and they want to know how many, and they want to know how many printers you have. And it bothers me that they're not thinking about what are the computers used for rather than how many do you have. So it seems to me that there are some legitimate reasons that a law school, legitimate reasons aside from teaching, that a law school might choose to have a computer lab. My problem comes in questioning whether or not the library is the appropriate place for the location of the lab. I have come to the conclusion it is not. I would like very much, if there were a new building built at Case Western, to either totally change the nature of this lab and to make it a teaching lab in which I would probably not feel as badly about the situation, or I would like to move it over and have it a teaching lab in the law school, perhaps used at night by the Student Bar Association. In any event, the points that I want to try to make for you in my concluding advice is that if it's decided in the overall interest of the law school that the library is going to be the place for locating a computer lab, it is crucial to try to get a definition, a goal statement as to what that lab is for and what the library's role in that lab will be. And I think that everyone needs to protect the interests of the library, because running these labs is very costly, and I think it's a poor use of a reference person's time or somebody else's time to just answer a question as to how to save a file and this kind of thing. And in the last 3 years, I've talked to a number of people. The traditional scenario, it seems to me, is that the lab is located adjacent to the reference office and that you're running back and forth and back and forth. And that bothers me, and it ought to bother your law school dean. If the dean knows why you exist in the first place, in that you're there to provide the link between the information and the patron who is seeking that information, the dean ought to be at least considering providing the proper kind of support to make that lab a success. I know this is probably a fairly strong statement. I'd like to say that it's just in nature of the computer labs that I'm sort of anti the library involvement. I don't regret a moment having gone through all this. It's been very educational. I think the whole process has had a secondary effect of providing me with information and knowledge that I can then apply and make appropriate arguments to the dean, actually to the director, and then we make them with the law school as to why the rest of the staff needs to have computers. It has increased the computer knowledge of all of the library staff, and we have had the initial benefit of having on the staff a person who was in that position I told you about, the computer lab supervisor, who's computer trained, and now we can approach our online catalog problems and some of the problems in the cataloging area of OCLC and our new GIAC system, and whether or not we should automate our budget, automate our acquisitions, do we go with these systems, this kind of stuff. We now have basically an in-house computer expert, and that's what we've gained. And I suppose the very last thing I want to say is, if you end up getting stuck with it, turn it to your advantage. You know, this is my message. Turn it to your advantage if you can do it. And it's, of course, totally dependent on the political atmosphere of your particular law school and the support that you're going to get from the law school. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat. Our next speaker is Professor Ralph Brill from the Chicago Kent College of Law. He is currently the Director of Research and Writing, and as such is one of the biggest users of their computer lab. And so he'll be telling us a little bit about what's there and give you a little bit more information on the tours there that are available after this program.
Thank you very much. I am not the director of the computer labs. I am director of research and writing. Ron Stout, who is our director, is down in Australia right now. Otherwise, he would be here. So I have no role in choosing hardware, software, and staffing, things of that sort. My role is primarily in the educational aspects of the computer program. And I guess the difference in what I'm going to say and the previous speakers is from that aspect. We have tried to make our computer labs, and we have three of them, an educational wing of the law school. And that's why we have chosen not to put it under the supervision of the library, but as an auxiliary to the library. We have been at this for quite a while, and we've been very happy to share some of our experiences and some of our evaluations of both hardware and software and other uses. A number of our faculty have been writing about this in various places, including the Journal of Legal Education. I do have some handouts at the back that I left for you from the student lawyer and from IBM that you might want to pick up later on. First of all, let's talk briefly about the labs. We started our first one 5 years ago, with a grant from IBM, we equipped a small lab of 24. I brought along some slides in case you're not taking a tour. So let's see here. Modern technology, okay. Forward, okay. This was the first of the labs. It held 24 IBM PCs and 6 printers. I don't know if we have to darken the room to see it. Somebody's going about doing that. This you can tell us, it's a student working at that lab. Subsequently, about a year later, we added a smaller lab of 15, each two serviced by its own printer, for a total of 39. About 2 years ago, we added our major classroom laboratory. And this one has a total of 36 IBM XTs. This is a teaching room. It's located in the library. It's the very first thing you see in the library when you walk in. It's about the size of a regular classroom. And, okay, that helps a little bit. Can everybody see that or not? It's difficult from this angle to tell. This is the speaker's computer. Let me go back and see if I can show you these better. Okay. Up at the front, at the very top, there is a blackboard and a podium, and that's where the teacher would stand with his or her computer. Each of those computers is linked to a monitor at each of the stations. Each of the stations has two computers, a printer, and a monitor right down the middle, so that where the older man is sitting there, there's to his right a monitor linked up to the instructor's computer, so that the students can see what I am doing when I'm teaching Lexis or when we're teaching the word processor. This is the computer at the podium. This would be a typical workstation, so there are two computers, one printer, one monitor in the middle. It's an excellent classroom for teaching not just computer use. We also use it for teaching some other things, and I'll get to that later on. In legal writing, for example, we actually conduct some classes in here on writing. Each of the computers has a hard disk. I guess we're talking about adding a token ring right now, but right now we have XTs and PCs that have been modified with hard disks. So we have loaded a menu of software on each of the computers. This would be the first screen that a student sees at the start of the day. Enter your ID number, which is their social security number. By using their social security, we also can keep track of who is using the computer. There's another screen that follows this that asks them to identify for what purpose they're using it, whether they're using it for legal writing or for torts or for some other class or for a CAI lesson. So we have statistics that we can maintain for evaluation. When they enter their ID number, they then get a screen that has a number of 7 different categories. First is word processors. We have 2 or 3 word processors loaded on the hard disk itself. Now, we mainly use Framework and WordStar, but we are equipped to service others as well. We have WordPerfect and a number of others that are available. There is MicroStairs, which is a mini version of the Lexis type system of word searches so that people can build their own databases and search them in the Lexis manner instead of by indices. Utilities are just things for formatting, and it saves time for formatting if you press the utilities number instead of going through the DOS system. Number 4 are instructional lessons. All the Kali exercises are loaded on the hard disk, or at least those that are used by the instructors. Number 5 is law practice. We have a lot of CLE programs that we conduct in our lab, and so we have a number of the programs that Mr. Pope mentioned before. Crosstalk is number 6, which gets us into several other databases, including ABANet, and we therefore can link up with other computer programs. And finally, 7 is legal communications, which is, of course, Lexis and Westlaw and Nexus. The student can choose for this one, for example, is not a very good likeness of the screen for Framework. word processing, and this is an actual part of when I took this the other day over somebody's shoulder. She was doing an outline for corporations course and framework. Actually, this is a little better to show you what framework does. Framework, it works on a system of, in effect, index cards. You can think of these as being several different index cards laid on a table. You can do your text and your footnotes, or in this case, there is the text is at the top, brief of the case is at the bottom, and there's an outline along the right-hand sides. The student can jump back and forth between each of these things all at the same time. You can put 10 or so different index cards in the table at the same time. So you can move things from one screen to the other, one file to the other. It's a fairly decent word processor. It's a little harder to use in things like WordPerfect or WordStar, but it has some features that we like. It has an outliner. It has a spreadsheet. This is a spreadsheet part of framework. It has graphics. It has a communications. It has a database of its own. It has a spell check and all the other kinds of things. This is the screen for the communications. We give them a choice, of course, Lexis and Westlaw. We have a number of lines, seven Lexis lines and four Westlaw. And by pressing either the number one for Lexis, at that point we have an automatic handshake, we call it, which automatically dials up Lexis through MediaNet, enters the ID number. You notice at the bottom there are some asterisks. The students never see the number so that they cannot memorize it and then use it themselves elsewhere. So we have control there for a student using it for educational purposes. And it's just an automatic dial. It dials through all the available numbers till it finds one that is open, and then there's that one, and the student is online. That's basically the slide. When we made the decision to heavily computerize our school, it was not an uncontroversial decision, as you might expect. Despite the fact that we had some aid from IBM, we invested a lot of our own money in the laboratories and the equipment, and a lot, of course, in the software. And we had some resistance from the faculty who said that it really wasn't the purpose of a law school to teach what was basically typing and to provide high-class typewriters for our students. So it was our job to really demonstrate that this was more than a tool that was used for typing, but could be integrated and improve legal education, as well as, of course, the practice of law. And so what follows are some of the things that we do with our computer labs and our computer training. We begin the week before school starts. We bring our freshmen in a week early for an orientation week. The very first thing they have are the very typical things. The dean deals with them for 2 hours on the anatomy of a lawsuit, things like motions to dismiss and what the function of a jury is and that sort of thing. I talk to them about 2 hours on their role as law students, on briefing cases and outlining. And they have their first legal writing class in which they talk about the legal system, the levels of courts, holding and dicta, the things you really need to know before you start law school, before you begin writing cases. They then have we then break them up into groups of experienced users versus non-experienced users. We, of course, are finding more and more experienced users coming in, and that's the reason why you're getting all those questions about what kind of equipment you have and how many printers you have. Depending upon their experience, we break them into different classes and have introduction to computers. In the computer session, they are taught basic word processing using Framework 2. At those early sessions, our intention is merely to get them able to do enough, to know enough to prepare simple briefs or briefs of cases for their first class. And they have their first torts class during that orientation week. So they prepare their briefs for that class using the computer. Following the torts class, which was the usual torts class taught by the regular torts professors, they meet in discussion sections tied into their legal writing sections. The legal writing professors meet with them to talk about what they just went through in their torts class. They do that, first of all, from a legal method point of view. They talk about holding and dictum again and what the function of the jury was and what the instruction of the jury meant and whether that was the key of the issues. But they also review their briefs of the cases, whether they've seen the right issues, whether the briefs that they have are something that will help them in dealing with the cases while going through class and reviewing. They then have a second computer class, again about 3 hours. At that point, they are taught how to use the computer to revise their briefs, to get them correct, to incorporate their class notes from that early torts class and the discussion class, to begin putting them into a master set of materials, and to prepare their briefs for their next torts class, which then follows the next day. The second torts class meets the next day. It's again a typical torts class, and again there is a discussion class with the legal writing professors following to again review those materials, to again review their briefs, and to also start talking now about synthesis of materials, of how to put things together. They've now seen almost an entire chapter, what was the relationship of one doctrine to another, how do you start thinking about these things as a complete whole as opposed to a series of individual trees. That's a mixed metaphor if I've ever heard one. And they then have a third computer class, and in that computer class, the focus is on outlining. Again, putting together an outline of the materials in their torts class that they have studied and that they are about to study for the next class. And the outliner and framework is used as a basis for teaching them how to do this using the computer as a tool. Then the first week of school in the legal writing classes, we continue doing the same sort of thing. Their first assignment is passed out, but along with that is a discussion problem. They're given a fact situation and a series of seven or eight cases and a statute. And they're asked again to brief those and bring them with to the next class. They again use the computer to do these briefs. The legal writing professors at the next class will talk about the cases and review the briefs. They will then have an opportunity to go back and correct those briefs. And they always do make mistakes at this level, to make them correct, to see what they missed, to see what the important points were, what the key facts were that they were not emphasizing, and why they were emphasizing facts that were not important. And then they're asked to prepare an outline, as if they were to prepare a memorandum on that problem. And for the next class, they're to turn in that outline, again, using the computer as a basis for doing the outline. And at that class, again, the outline is discussed, the logical order of it. It's amazing how many students really know very little about outlining or anything about logic, for that matter. And so you spend a lot of time going through what a basic outline should look like. They don't seem to know that if you have an A, you have to have a B, that it can't just be an A and one A. So you have to do the basic outline kinds of things as well. And then for the third class, they're told to prepare a kind of a rough draft of a memo based upon that outline. Not a detailed one. We don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but a kind of a topic sentence outline of what they would write. And then that class meets in the computer lab. And we go through the rough drafts and actually then compose the memorandum that would have been written on that problem together. They can follow, while I'm teaching the class at least, they can follow on this monitor. We talk about what should be the first paragraph. How would we start? And we draft a possible first paragraph. And then we reorganize it or revise it and shorten it. And what should be the second paragraph? And they see all this on the screen right before them. And, of course, when we get finished, we print it out and then Xerox it for them as their sample memo or one of the sample memos that they have in the course. We have some further computer classes as their first papers become, as the deadline for the first papers become closer, talk about some of the more sophisticated aspects of word processing, italicizing, paging, getting a table of cases, and things of that sort. And they, of course, most of them use the computer for doing their papers. At our school, we require rewrites of all but one paper in the first year. So after the papers are critiqued, they, of course, will rewrite them, but since they have them on disk, it becomes an easier process and a much better process for them to be able to rewrite. In addition, we have experimented with, in my classes, for example, I give them the option instead of turning in hard copy, of just turning in their disks, and I grade their papers on the disks. What I have found from this, to my surprise, frankly, is that I do a much better job, a much more thorough job of critiquing their papers. And more importantly, I do it at the appropriate place. I just move apart their paragraphs and put in brackets and in bold my comments, or I rewrite a portion of their papers at the appropriate place. It forces them to read what they have written first and then my comments, whereas normally if you write in the margin, all they look at is the comments. They don't really read what generated those comments. So it really comes at the best possible place, right in the middle of it, and they can also compare what I've written to what they've written. And, of course, you can write extensive notes at the end as well with the computer. And then I just pass the master back their disk, and they have to read the whole thing in order to find the grade, unless they know how to get to the end by hitting control N. I suppose they can shift on to the end. Most of them do that. So that's been a kind of an interesting find, that by the disk, it really has added immensely to the grading process. It also adds immensely, we have found, by just anecdotally, to the writing process. They don't have the heavy investment in paper. I have students come to me with a draft, and I make some comments, and they come back an hour later with a new draft. And that never would have happened before, because they would have had to do it all over again or pay somebody else to do it all over again. They don't have that investment, and so they are willing to polish and move things around and shorten. Now, we continue it. We've tried an experiment this last year of final exams on computers. In my torts class this year, I gave them the option of, we've let them type for a number of years. This year, we gave them the option of doing their examinations on the computers. We furnished the disks. We've, of course, assigned them to the computer. They can't bring anything else in, so we let them get to Lexis and Westlaw, so they can't do any research during it. And it works out fine. They are, again, able to save time and polish what they've written. The second semester is when we first teach Lexis and Westlaw, and we do that rather late in the semester. Unlike a lot of schools, we don't introduce them to Lexis and Westlaw until after they've gone through all the first drafts of all their papers. So it's about halfway through the second semester that they get Lexis Westlaw training. Most of you have had temporary learning centers set up by those companies. We have, of course, a permanent temporary learning center. All the computers, almost all the computers in that teaching lab are hooked up with modems and can access both. And with the cooperation of both companies, we get a sufficient number of training lines to be able to teach each of the legal writing sections for a week at a time, Lexis, and then the following week, Westlaw. And each student has his or her computer available both during class time and for a period of time, an hour or two outside of class, to do some hands-on exercises. So that they, I think, get a much better experience than standing around watching somebody else on a large terminal as we used to do it, or even with the temporary learning centers where you have maybe 10 UBIX that are brought in for the occasion. I mentioned before taking exams on final. Several of our teachers are experimenting in other ways as well with finals. In our evidence class, Professor Kadish has used, there is a combination computer and video game program on evidence. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's a trial, and it's like Dungeons and Dragons in those arcades. A trial is going on, and at the appropriate place, you would enter an objection, and it then asks you to type in the nature of your objection. There are, of course, some code words like hearsay, and it then rules upon it, and depending upon the outcome, whether it overrules or sustains your objection, the trial then goes forward with that evidence either in or out, so that you won't, if it's sustained, you will not see that answer. It is just jumps to a different portion of the laser disk. And he gives them that as part of their final exam. Each one must take that. It automatically scores it, so he doesn't even have to grade the blue book as part of their exam. And it's a fascinating kind of thing. We have it at the school. If anybody wants to look at it later, we can probably show it to you. That's the first year. In the second year, we, of course, have a three-year research and writing requirement at Kent, and that facilitates a lot of other things that we can do. In our advanced research class, which is a second-year requirement, students take sections devoted to either tax or security or labor law or environmental law, international law research. And so we can focus on specialty research in those classes. And what we, as far as the computer is concerned, we have 8 hours in class devoted to additional Lexis and Westlaw and Nexus instruction. Once again, the companies cooperate with us by offering lines available during certain periods, and we can teach them the specialty databases. If they're in a tax session, they will, of course, learn the tax database, and they make available even Nexus for us, which is we teach them empirical research as part of this course, and Nexus is a large part of that. In our legal drafting course, which is our other second-year required course, we use two classes out of that 14-week period to teach them some of the programs that Mr. Pope mentioned before, plus some that Jim Sproul has been in our faculty have developed on expert systems. GEM system is a system that helps you design your own document design system for basic legal instruments. We think this is one of the things that will be occurring much more frequently in legal practice, that you will be not just using programs that you buy off the shelf, but also developing your own. And so we try to teach them, at least to some extent, how to go about doing that. We have some other courses devoted to computers and the law. We have a course basically in computers and law, which is a substantive law course on trademark and things of that sort. But we also have one in computer applications to law practice. And next year we will have an interesting course in litigation. We have a two-semester trials course now. We have about 12 sections of that course, about 10 students each. We are going to have, as an experiment, some of those sections that are tied on to the computer system so that they will take as a pre-course a course in pretrial discovery, and they will load all their discovery and interrogatories and things that they will play with during that course onto the computer and search and retrieve. And then in their sections of trials, when they take that course, they will use those materials and be able to retrieve them in the courtroom with computers. And those classes will be held. We have a judge in Chicago in the federal court, Judge Prentice Marshall, I hope you've heard of. He's a wonderful judge. And his courtroom is computerized. The court reporters type into a computer for instant review. He often reads other things while the case is going on. And if there's an objection, he plays back on the computer instantaneously the transcript. And so we're going to do the trials classes in that courtroom, which is rigged for computerization. And so it will be an interesting course in litigation. In addition, in a number of the substantive courses, the instructors will be using spreadsheets, for example, in taxation and corporations. There are a number of programs that will be assigned. And there are, of course, upper-level computer-assisted instruction exercises. There's an excellent one on bankruptcy, for example. We, of course, had an interest in evaluating this program, and last year had a social scientist who was working on his PhD. I guess he was actually a teacher in high school. It was a tenured article. Do an analysis of the impact of computer use upon our students. Our faculty, of course, was justifiably worried that the computer might have a negative effect upon the students, that they by all this outside of, we train them outside of class. These are not for credit courses. We make them go to these classes, and they go outside of class. Freshmen, you can do almost anything to. You can say, go, and they go. It's something you ought to learn. You get them then. You can't get them after that. But freshmen, you can tell to do something, and they'll do it. And so these are outside of class things, and they do take a lot of time. And so there's some fear that learning this and outside of class exercises to learn it and having to master it might take away from their other studying and have a negative impact. Our preliminary findings were shocking even to me. I thought it wouldn't hurt them, at least. We found that it seemed to help, that especially for those that had the lowest LSATs, that their predicted that they exceeded the predicted grade point average by about 0.2, and that in legal writing especially the classes all had a much greater predicted grade point average, about 0.35, especially again those at the bottom of the class. And having taught this, I can tell you that that's true, because as I said before, they don't have this investment in paper. They're much more willing to do something, to change something, to polish it and change it and to do it over, and to integrate things that we have taught them. So the faculty is very happy, and this year did an analysis of the computer program, and instead of coming down and saying get rid of it or cut it down, or what they said is we want a more robust program. That was their language, not mine. Get it into more courses and do even more things with it than you are doing. And so we are trying to do that. We run a number of CLE courses. We run about 10 CLE courses and computers alone per year. We let the computer labs be used by law firms for training their own people, paralegals and lawyers. It's in heavy use in non-peak hours. We do that during the summer, during the semester when it's not being heavily used for other reasons. The computers are available. There are three of them, as I said before. There are two of them are on the sixth floor outside the library. The one with the 36 is in the library. I happen to believe that it should be in the library, but that I also believe that it should not be under the supervision of the library unless they happen to have experts in computers. I think the library is the best place for it because that's where the books are and the things that they're going to be working with. In our configuration, we have desks, one whole desk available for each computer where they can lay out all their books while they type away. So there's plenty of room for them to spread out books and other things and yellow pads, and then just have plenty of room for the keyboard and the computer itself. So it's ideal. They can bring books in there and then take them back out, and they don't have to take them out of the library, which they would have to do, or else heavily use the Xerox machines, which, of course, always break down. So I think the library is the best place for it if there is room. And the classroom is not affected by the library use. It's not noisy. It's built well for that. There is no adverse impact on the library. The staffing, to get back to the theme of this, incidentally, labs are available except when they're being used for teaching. All the hours that the library or the building are open, the two on the sixth floor are open even longer hours than the library ones because the library has somewhat shorter hours than the building itself does. So students can get at them from early in the morning till very, very late at night and all weekend. The staffing is done through the Center for Law and Computers. Ron Stout is a professor, and he is the director of that program. He has an assistant who is primarily a computer person. She is mainly an administrator, but also is technically trained and can help with programming and other things in a pinch if necessary. She is an excellent computer person. We also have two computer fellows who are primarily responsible for teaching the word processing, data processing, other kinds of things, and developing software. We have done a lot of that on our own. And a very important function is one that was mentioned before, is evaluating software. There's more and more coming out every day, and it's very difficult to know what's good and what isn't, and what's usable for a law school and what isn't. It's their job, or at least one aspect of their job, to evaluate the software as it comes in and to see whether it's adaptable or usable in our labs or in our CLE programs for lawyers. In addition, we have a lab manager who is a computer person, a technical person who is in charge of setting up the equipment, servicing it, fixing it if it's down, programming it. And he has an assistant lab manager who is also a technical person. Both of these are PhD candidates in computer science at our own university usually, so we have that ability to get pretty good people. In addition, we have a whole host of part-time lab assistants. These are mainly students. Some of them do it for money, and some of them do it just for extra use of the computers. We certainly do not have any sign-up sheets. It's first come, first served. But since we have 75, we have found absolutely no problems in even in crunch periods. Surprisingly, enough people get them all in. Most of our night students have access to computers outside of the school, either in their offices or at home. And we have found that a large number of other students are buying their own computers for home or already had them. So we have not found any kind of crunch and therefore no necessity for having sign-ups. We don't charge the students any fees for using the computer facilities, and we furnish all the paper and everything else as part of their tuition. The only thing they're required to do is to buy and bring their own disks. We don't furnish the disks, but disks are available at cost in our bookstore. So that it's reasonable from their point of view. It's expensive. I would estimate that the cost of our computer facilities annually is about, including salaries, is about $250,000 to $300,000. But some of that is offset by the fees generated by CLE courses. Some of it was offset by the grant from IBM and several other smaller grants. But mainly it's justified just because we treat it as an educational program rather than an equipment program. Since we have tied it into the curriculum, since we have tried as best we can to make it a tool for legal education as well as a tool for the practice of law, we don't charge them for taking a course in torts or contracts separately. We don't charge them, therefore, for the computer. So the library's role is minimal, which they, I think, Virginia, you will correct me if I'm wrong, I think they welcome. They don't have to deal with the problems Ms. Harris talked about, of having to change the paper and solve a computer problem that they might not know anything about. They can deal with the things that they are expert in on reader services and other kinds of services. And we have the technical staff who is available to be able to help the students with the computer programs, computer problems, and the education of how to use the software. So it seems to be a happy marriage It also, I think, is politically a good idea because it means there's a separate budget for another program rather than coming out of a library budget that some outside observer may say is getting rather large if you have a computer center that you're servicing as well. So just politically, I think it looks better to have it as a separate. Finally, I understand that there have been arrangements made for a tour of our labs. You're, of course, welcome to come there. There was a misunderstanding as to the numbers that were. There is no limit. Anybody who wants to come should come after this program, or I'll be there until about 8 o'clock tonight. We are at 77 South Wacker. That's at Wacker and Monroe. It's a block away from the Sears Tower, right across from the Mercantile Exchange. And the teaching classroom is on the fourth floor in the main part of the library. So if you will come, I will be happy to demonstrate the computers and the programs that we have loaded on it and answer any of your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ralph. I'd like to thank all of our speakers today, and I'd also like to thank all of you for coming and remind you to leave the evaluation forms on the table at the back. We've run past our scheduled time. I'm sure the speakers would be willing to stay for a couple of minutes to answer any quick questions you might have, but I'm sure some of you are eager to get on out to Chicago Kent and to other programs and activities. Thank you.
This concludes our program. This cassette was produced by Mobile Tape Company, Incorporated of Glendale, California.